saying goodbye to them both so soon after arriving home, but they won't hear of him staying.
"Don't come back without Geeta,"
are the last words Goldie says as Lale climbs into the back of the cart and is nearly thrown out by the horse taking off.
He looks back at the two women standing outside his family home, each with an arm around the other, smiling, waving.
For 3 days and nights, Lale and his new companion travel down broken roads and through bombed-out towns. They ford streams where bridges have been destroyed. They give lifts to various people along the way. Lale eats sparingly from his rations. He feels profound grief for his scattered family.
At the same time, he longs for Geeta, and this gives him the sense of purpose he needs to carry on. He must find her. He has promised. When he eventually arrives back in Bratislava, he goes immediately to the train station.
"Is it true that survivors from the concentration camps have been coming home?"
he asks. He is told it is, and is given the train schedule. With no idea where Geeta might have ended up, not even which country, he decides the only thing to do is meet every train. He thinks about finding somewhere to stay, but a strange man and a horse is not an attractive proposition as a lodger, so he sleeps in his cart, in whatever spot of vacant land he can find, for as long as it takes for the horse to eat the grass, or for them to be moved along. He is often reminded of his friends in the gypsy camp, and the stories they told him about their way of life. It is nearing the end of summer. The rain is frequent, but doesn't deter him.
For 2 weeks, Lale loiters at the train station as each arrival pulls in. He walks up and down the platform, approaching every disembarking woman.
"Were you in Birkenau?"
On the few occasions he gets a yes, he asks,
"Did you know Geeta Furman? She was in Block 29.
No one knows her. One day the station master asks him if he has registered Geeta with the Red Cross, who are taking the names of the missing and of those who have returned and are seeking loved ones. With nothing to lose, he heads into the city center to the address he has been given. Geeta is walking down the main street with two friends when she sees a funny-looking cart being drawn by a horse. A young man stands casually in the back. She steps out onto the road. Time stands still as the horse stops of its own volition in front of the young woman.
Lale climbs down from the cart. Geeta takes a step towards him. He doesn't move. She takes another step.
"Hello,"
she says. Lale drops to his knees.
Geeta turns around to her two friends, who are looking on in astonishment.
"Is it him?"
one of them calls out.
"Yes,"
says Geeta.
"It is him."
Clearly, Lale is not going to move, or is incapable of moving. So Geeta walks to him.
Kneeling down in front of him, she says,
"In case you didn't hear me when we left Birkenau, I love you. Will you marry me?"
he says.
"Yes, I will. Will you make me the happiest man in the world?" "Yes."
Lale sweeps Geeta up into his arms and kisses her. One of Geeta's friends comes over and leads the horse away. Then with Geeta's arms around Lale's waist and her head resting on his shoulder, they walk away, merging into the crowded street, one young couple among many in a war-ravaged city.
Epilogue.
Lale changed his name to Sokolov, the Russian surname of his married sister.
A name more readily accepted than Eisenberg in Soviet-controlled Slovakia.
He and Gita were married in October 1945, and they set up home in Bratislava. Lale started importing fine fabrics, linen, silk, cotton, from throughout Europe and Asia.
He sold these on to manufacturers desperate to rebuild and reclothe their country.
With the Soviet Union having taken over Czechoslovakia, according to Lale, his was the only business not immediately nationalized by the communist rulers.
He was, after all, providing the very materials the government hierarchy wanted for their personal use. The business grew, he took on a partner and profits increased.
Once again, Lale began wearing stylish clothing.
He and Gita dined at the best restaurants and holidayed at spa complexes around the Soviet Union. They were strong supporters of a movement to establish a Jewish state in Israel. Gita, in particular, worked quietly behind the scenes, obtaining money from wealthy locals and arranging for it to be smuggled out of the country.
When the marriage of Lale's business partner ended, his ex-wife reported Lale and Gita's activities to the authorities. On the 20th of April 1948, Lale was arrested and charged with exporting jewelry and other valuables from Czechoslovakia.
The arrest warrant continued. As a result, Czechoslovakia would have suffered untold economic losses, and Sokolov would have obtained, for his unlawful and marauding actions, significant values in money or possessions.
While Lale had been exporting jewelry and money, there was nothing financial in it for him. He'd been giving money away.
2 days later, his business was nationalized, and he was sentenced to 2 years in Ilava prison, a place famous for holding political and German prisoners after the war.
Lale and Gita had been smart enough to stash some of their wealth.
With contacts in the local government and judiciary, Gita was able to bribe officials to help.
One day Lale received a visit in prison from a Catholic priest. After a while, the priest asked the prison officials to leave the room so he could hear Lale's confession, something that was sacrosanct and for his ears only. Alone, he told Lale to start acting as though he were going mad. If he did a good enough job, they would have to get a psychiatrist to see him. Before too long, Lale found himself in front of a psychiatrist, who told him he was going to arrange for him to be given leave to go home for a few days before he went over the edge and couldn't be brought back.
A week later, he was driven to the apartment where he and Gita lived. He was told he would be picked up in 2 days to complete his sentence. That night, with the help of friends, they slipped out of the back of their apartment building with a suitcase, each of possessions, and a painting that Gita refused to leave behind. The painting is of a gypsy woman. They also took a large amount of money to give to a contact in Vienna, destined for Israel. Then they hid behind the false wall of a truck, taking produce from Bratislava into Austria.
At a given time, on a given day, they walked along a platform at Vienna train station looking for a contact they had never met. Lale described it as like something out of a Le Carré novel. They muttered a password to several single gentlemen until finally one gave the appropriate response.
Lale slipped a small briefcase of money to the man, and then he disappeared. From Vienna they traveled to Paris, where they rented an apartment and for several months enjoyed the cafes and bars of the city, returning to its pre-war self.
Seeing Josephine Baker, the brilliant black American singer and dancer, perform in cabaret was a memory Lale would always carry with him. He described her as having legs up to here, indicating his waist. With no work available for non-French citizens, Lale and Gita decided to leave France.
They wanted to go as far away from Europe as possible. So they bought fraudulent passports and set sail for Sydney, where they landed on the 29th of July 1949.
On the ship over, they befriended a couple who told them about their family in Melbourne, with whom they intended to live. That was enough to persuade Lale and Gita to settle in Melbourne too. Once again, Lale entered the textile trade.
He bought a small warehouse and set about sourcing fabrics locally and abroad to sell on. Gita decided she wanted to be part of the business too and enrolled in a dress design course. She subsequently started designing women's clothing, which added another dimension to their business. Their greatest desire was to have a child, but it simply would not happen for them. Eventually they gave up hope. Then, to their great surprise and delight, Geeta fell pregnant.
Their son Gary was born in 1961, when Geeta was 36 and Lale was 44.
Their life was full, with a child, friends, a successful business, and holidays on the Gold Coast, all supported by a love that no hardship had been able to break. The painting of the gypsy woman Geeta brought with them from Slovakia still hangs in Gary's house.
Author's note. I'm in the lounge of the home of an elderly man. I don't know him well yet, but I've quickly come to know his dogs, Tootsie and Bam Bam. One the size of a pony and the other smaller than my cat. Thankfully, I've won them over, and right now they're asleep. I look away for a moment. I have to tell him. You do know I'm not Jewish. An hour has passed since we met. The elderly man in the chair opposite me gives an impatient but not unfriendly snort. He looks away, folds his fingers. His legs are crossed, and the free foot wraps a silent beat. His eyes look towards the window and the open space.
Yes, he says finally, turning to me with a smile. That's why I want you.
I relax a little. Maybe I am in the right place after all. So, he says, as though he's about to share a joke,
tell me what you know about Jews.
Seven branch candlesticks come to mind as I scramble for something to say.
Do you know any Jews?
I come up with one. I work with a girl named Bella. She's Jewish, I think. I expect disdain, but instead receive enthusiasm.
Good,
he says. I've passed another test. Next comes the first instruction. You will have no preconceptions about what I tell you. He pauses, as though searching for words.
I don't want any personal baggage brought to my story.
I shift uncomfortably. Maybe there is some. He leans forward unsteady. He catches the table with a hand. The table is unsteady, and its uneven legs smacks against the floor, causing an echo. The dogs wake up, startled. I swallow. My mother's name was Schwartfeger. Her family were German. He relaxes.
We all come from somewhere, he says.
Yes, but I'm a Kiwi. My mother's family have lived in New Zealand for over 100 years.
Immigrants?
Yes. He sits back, relaxed now.
How quickly can you write?
He asks. I'm thrown off balance. What exactly is he asking here? Well, it depends on what I'm writing.
I need you to work quickly. I don't have much time.
Panic. I had deliberately not brought any recording or writing materials with me to this first meeting. I'd been invited to hear and consider writing his life story. For now, I just wanted to listen. How much time do you have? I ask him.
A little while only.
I'm confused. Do you have to be somewhere soon?
Yes,
he says, his gaze again returning to the open window.
I need to be with Geeta.
I never met Geeta. It was her death and Lale's need to join her that pushed him to tell his story. He wanted it to be recorded so, in his words, it would never happen again. After that first meeting, I visited Lale 2 or 3 times a week. The story took 3 years to untangle. I had to earn his trust, and it took time before he was willing to embark on the deep self-scrutiny that parts of his story required. We had become friends. No, more than friends. Our lives became entwined as he shed the burden of guilt he had carried for over 50 years. The fear that he and Geeta might be seen as collaborators of the Nazis. Part of Lale's burden passed to me as I sat with him at his kitchen table, This dear man, with his trembling hands, his quivering voice, his eyes that still moistened 60 years after experiencing these most horrifying events in human history. He told his story piecemeal, sometimes slowly, sometimes at bullet pace, and without clear connections between the many, many episodes. But it didn't matter. It was spellbinding to sit with him and his two dogs, and listen to what an uninterested ear might have sounded like the ramblings of an old man. Was it the delightful Eastern European accent? The charm of this old rascal? Was it the twisted story I was starting to make sense of? It was all of these and more. As the teller of Lale's story, it became important for me to identify how memory and history sometimes waltz in step and sometimes strained apart, to present not a lesson in history, of which there are many, but a unique lesson in humanity. Lale's memories were, on the whole, remarkably clear and precise. They matched my research into people, dates, and places. Was this a comfort? Getting to know a person for whom such terrible facts had been a lived reality made them all the more horrific. There was no parting of memory and history for this beautiful old man. They waltzed perfectly in step. The Tattooist of Auschwitz is a story of two ordinary people living in an extraordinary time, deprived not only of their freedom, but their dignity, their names, and their identities. And it is Lale's account of what they needed to do to survive. Lale lived his life by the motto, "If you wake up in the morning, it's a good day." On the morning of his funeral, I woke knowing it was not a good day for me, but that it would have been for him. He was now with Geeta. Additional information. Lale was born Ludwig Eisenberg on 28th of October 1916 in Krompachy, Slovakia. He was transported to Auschwitz on the 23rd of April 1942 and tattooed with the number 32407. Geeta was born Gisela Firmanova, Firman, on 11th of March 1925 in Vranov nad Topol, Slovakia. She was transported to Auschwitz on the 13th of April 1942 and tattooed with the number 34902. And she was retattooed by Lale in July when she moved from Auschwitz to Birkenau. Lale's parents, Josef and Serena Eisenberg, were transported to Auschwitz on the 26th of March 1942 while Lale was still in Prague. Research has uncovered that they were killed immediately upon arrival at Auschwitz. Lale never knew this. It was discovered after his death. Lale was imprisoned in the Strafkompanie, penal unit, from the 16th of June to the 10th of July 1944, where he was tortured by Jakob. No one was expected to survive or be released from that unit. Geeta's neighbor, Mrs. Goldstein, survived and made her way home to Vranov nad Topol. Silke was charged as a Nazi conspirator and sentenced to 15 years hard labor, which she served in Siberia. Afterwards, she returned to Bratislava. She and Geeta met only once in the mid-1970s when Geeta went to visit her two brothers. In 1961, Stefan Baretsky was tried in Frankfurt and sentenced to life imprisonment for war crimes. On the 21st of June 1988, he committed suicide in the Konitsky Sift Hospital in Bad Nauheim, Germany. Geeta died on the 3rd of October 2003. Lale died on the 31st of October 2006. Afterword. Gary Sokolov. When I was asked to write an afterword for the book, It was a very daunting request. Memories at so many different levels kept flooding my mind, and I was unable to get started. Do I talk about food, which was a primary focus for both my parents, but especially my mother, who took pride in a fridge filled with chicken schnitzels, cold cuts, and myriad cakes and fruit? I remember her devastation when, in year 11, I went on a major diet. On Friday night, she served me my traditional three schnitzels, and I'll never forget the look on her face when I placed two of them back in the tray. "What's wrong? Is my cooking no good anymore?" she asked. It was very hard for her to register that I could no longer eat the quantity I used to. To compensate for this, when my friend came over, he said hello to me and went straight to the fridge. This made her very happy. Our home was always inviting and accepting of everyone. Both Mum and Dad were very supportive of any and all hobbies and activities that I wanted to try, and keen to introduce me to everything, skiing, travel, horse riding, parasailing, and more. They felt they were robbed of their own youth and did not want me to miss out on anything. Growing up, it was a very loving family life. The devotion my parents had to each other was total and uncompromising. When many in their circle of friends started getting divorced, I went to my mother and asked her how she and my father had managed to stay together for so many years. Her response was very simple. "Nobody is perfect. Your father has always taken care of me since the first day we met in Birkenau. I know he is not perfect, but I also know he will always put me first." The house was always full of love and affection, especially for me, and after 50 years of marriage, to see them both cuddling and holding hands and kissing, I believe this has allowed me to be a very outwardly loving and caring husband and father. Both my parents were determined that I should know what they went through. When the TV series The World at War started, I was 13, and they made me watch it by myself every week. They were unable to watch it with me. I remember when they were showing live footage of the camps, I looked to see if I could spot my parents. That footage is stuck in my mind even now. My father was comfortable to talk about his adventures in the camp, but only on the Jewish festivals when he and the men would sit around the table and chat about their experiences, all of which were fascinating. Mum, however, said nothing of the details except on one occasion when she told me that in the camp, when she was very sick, her mother had come to her in a vision and told her, "You will get better, move to a faraway land, and have a son." I'll try to give you some insight into how those years affected them both. When my father was forced to close his business when I was 16, I came home from school just as our car was being towed away and an auction sign going up outside our home. Inside, my mum was packing up all our belongings. She was singing. "Well," I thought to myself, "they've just lost everything, and Mum is singing." She sat me down to tell me what was going on, and I asked her, "How can you just pack and sing?" With a big smile on her face, she said that when you spend years not knowing if in 5 minutes' time you will be dead, there is not much you can't deal with. She said, "As long as we're alive and healthy, everything will work out for the best." Certain things stuck with them. We would be walking along the street and Mum would bend down and pluck a 4- or 5-leaf clover from the ground, because when she was in the camp, if you found one and gave it to the German soldiers, who believed they were lucky, you received an extra portion of soup and bread. With Dad, it was the lack of emotion and heightened survival instinct that remained with him, to the point where even when his sister passed away, he did not shed a tear. When I asked him about this, he said that after seeing death on such a grand scale for so many years, and after losing his parents and brother, he found he was unable to weep. That is, until Mum passed away. It was the first time I'd ever seen him cry. Most of all, I remember the warmth at home, always filled with love smiles, affection, food, and my father's sharp, dry wit. It was an amazing environment to grow up in, and I will always be grateful to my parents for showing me this way of life.
Belinda Audio and Zaffa Publishing hope you enjoyed this recording of The Tattooist of Auschwitz, written by Heather Morris and read by Richard Armitage. Our audiobooks are becoming increasingly popular among travellers, families, and people who are on the go. If you really enjoyed this audiobook, please introduce your friends and family to the experience. We're sure they'll love you for it. If you want to hear more about our fabulous range of titles, please visit us online at belinda.com. Thanks for listening, and remember to always take a Belinda audiobook with you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.